Lockwood, last week, Wes primarily led the program, which is wonderful, concerning our representation in estate-related matters. And sometimes, as Wes used the terminology, sometimes we're kind of looking inside the estate, mm-hmm. you know, on behalf of, you know, an interested party, a beneficiary. Other times we're looking kind of outside the estate, representing, you know, the executors, the trustee. Fiduciary law can kind of come at Carvel and Collins in a multitude of different ways. And I ended the program last week with just the concept, the reality that our listeners, it's very important that you consult with and hire eventually a lawyer that has experience in fiduciary law matters, because these files kind of frame up in a certain way. And we at Harvell and Collins, of course, have had a lot of experience with factual scenarios, and they tend to some degree to kind of repeat themselves. And then we have the experience set, if you will, to be able to deal with it very effectively for the client. Let me kind of say this too, off the cuff. All of we lawyers are always asked by our friends, or if we meet someone in a new setting, well, what kind of law do you do, mm-hmm. and what kind of specialty do you have, Cecil? And of course, I always will say, well, I work primarily in trust and estates, and then I will sometimes say, you know, and I really like it. I actually, and here it comes, Lockwood, I consider it happy law.
Okay.
And the reason I consider it happy law for me, that is a very personal thing, is because, you know, I'm helping people on the front end get mm-hmm. their affairs in order, which is very comforting to them. Mm-hmm. And I'll sometimes get a phone call or a note after a file is completed, you know, a few weeks later, just, you know, thank you so much, Cecil. We feel so much better. We feel so comforted by the fact that we do have our affairs in order. And then the other aspect is on the other side of settling the estate when, of course, unfortunately, those clients have now lost a loved one, is that, yes, it's a very sad time. It's a very emotional time, but that's when we at the law firm are really able to hold their hand through this very mm-hmm. difficult time and guide them, dot the I's, cross the T's, and guide them and kind of be a security blanket for them. So we're doing a lot of very pleasant things, in my opinion. This is my personal practice for clients. Now, it's inevitable, and here we go, Lockwood, back over to Mr. Collins. It's inevitable when you have the estate practice such as we have that sometimes things are not going to be or not going to go well. Some of the children are going to start fighting, or, you know, in a second marriage, potentially maybe even the spouses are in disagreement about things, the children of the spouses. It can just come at us from all sorts of directions. But the bottom line is that there are certainly times that that conflict develops, and we have to have an experienced lawyer such as Wes to come in and kind of and analyze the facts of those circumstances and then guide the client in the right direction. And so Wes is extraordinarily busy in the area of fiduciary law litigation, and that too can be very rewarding, right, Wes? Because, you know, we're helping people in a difficult time, even though there's conflict, we're helping them settle the matter and seek some sort of resolution. I know you agree with that, right, Wes?
I would. I think that kind of just, you know, we're all wired up differently, right?
Right.
And I totally agree, Cecil, with your comment that you are handling things for folks that are that's happy law and pleasant in most cases. You know, you're kind of avoiding the possibilities. I would put it the possibility you're doing the work so we don't have problems later on. I would put it this way. I would say that for me, I appreciate and enjoy that type of practice as well to a certain extent. But I really think that winning is pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And it's kind of good. That's just the way I'm wired up. I mean, even when I coached little, recreation basketball or AAU basketball.
Hello? Right.
Are you there still?
Yeah. I'm here.
Okay. When I coached my recreation basketball team or my AAU basketball team, I always explained to them that the fun is not really showing up and just having a good time at practice. The fun is doing what a good basketball team does at practice, which is get better.
Right.
And then winning. Success. That's the fun.
Mm-hmm. Success.
Because then you get the reward from the work you put in.
Right.
And that's kind of the way I see, the litigation practice. You have to put the work in. I mean, mm-hmm. there's just no ifs, ands, or buts. Experience helps a ton. Knowing how to use evidence is incredibly important. I see lawyers all the time that don't really know how to use the information they've gotten through a case at trial in order to maximize winning. And so if you know how to properly present that to the jury so that you get the effect, that you want, for purposes of obviously representing the client well and putting them in the best position possible, then that's a skill, of course, that gets us closer to that pleasant winning that I'm talking
right.
about.
Yeah.
So I agree. There's different types. Now, but last week we were talking a little bit more about, kind of the fiduciary litigation type. I mean, this could be just estate administration or not really litigation yet. And there is a dynamic between are you on the outside looking in or are you on the inside looking out? And basically what we were saying is that if you represent the estate itself, you kind of are in control of things. Mm-hmm. Now, the will or the trust or whatever the document is that controls the assets, is you have to go by that. You can't just do whatever you want to do as an executor or the attorney or whatever position you're in on the inside. But at the same time, if you have, let's say, disgruntled beneficiaries because maybe the person who died did not leave them as much as they wanted, or things are not being done the way they want them to be done. In Lockwood, we get that all the time. We have right. situations, I wouldn't say all the time, but we have situations where just sometimes folks, they're not lawyers, they don't understand how things work,
right?
And they want you to do things in the administration of an estate that are just incredibly unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a waste of resources, maybe a business decision needs to be made about whether we're going to chase down this rabbit,
right?
Whatever it may be, and then they just get disgruntled about it. Well, if you're on the inside looking out, you're representing the estate, and you have this one beneficiary who's creating, turmoil. Well, all they're really doing, as long as you're administrating the estate properly as the attorney and the executor, is wasting the estate's money.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not probably going to get anywhere. I mean, at least in the states we deal with, it right. never happens that they get anywhere, basically, because we don't do things improperly.
Right.
We just follow the law. And in the event there's some kind of question about what needs to be done, then we may file even a declaratory judgment action before the clerk of court and get direction from the court. We just do it the right way. And so if you're on the outside looking in and you're making the estate spend money, then you're probably depleting your inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very likely that we will, if you're doing things that are just frivolous, that we will file a motion to protect the other beneficiaries in the estate for recovery of attorney's fees and costs.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're creating unnecessary expense for the litigation and you're, let's say, one of five beneficiaries, it's not fair for those other four beneficiaries' inheritance to be depleted just because you're being unreasonable. So that inside looking out gives you a lot of control with regard to that. But it also comes with it a lot of responsibility. You have to do things the right way, having the experience of knowing how to do things the right way, keeping the estate on the right path, seeking direction from the court, which is not required that often, but when it is, knowing how to do that properly is important. But then on the other side, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't always get to pick your clients. Sometimes you have clients who are on the out, who hire you to do something on, and you're on the outside looking in relative to an estate, and you have to guide them with regard to that. You can't necessarily do everything that they think needs to be done. I mean, just yesterday I had a client, I'm not going to get into too much detail, who sends an email to me and is wanting me to file all these motions in this clerk related matter, and with all these rules that apparently he had Googled or AI'd or something like that. And I looked them up, and they were all rules of evidence, and absolutely none of them would apply. So you got to tell your client in that situation, look, I got it. Let's discuss this. But just because you're asking me to do this, I'm not going to do it. I mean, that's like telling your surgeon how to operate on your brain. I mean, let's let the surgeon make the medical decisions.
This goes back to something that you said last week when we were talking about this. You need justification. You need real reason to challenge an estate. It's not something you just do arbitrarily. I want to go back to that comment. I thought that was interesting. It's not something you just casually do. This is something that really is a challenge for the individual who's wanting to challenge an estate. Am I correct on that?
No doubt about it. I mean, I sit down with folks all the time, and they want to challenge the will, you know, after someone's died, or they're dealing with a will challenge that someone's filed. I just had one yesterday. It was a little bit of a complex matter. We had a hearing in Craven County. Not going to get into too much detail, but that one, they had filed a challenge to the will. They lost that challenge on summary judgment, but it was entirely frivolous. There was no basis for bringing it. And under North Carolina General Statute 6-21 sub 2, when you're in a caveat proceeding, upon the conclusion of that, either party can get their attorney's fees and cost. And so I protected my client's rights there and filed the motion for recovery of attorney's fees. And the court allowed that. It really wasn't even a frivolous standard. It was a the standard there is basically that normally the prevailing party is going to get their attorney's fees. Even a losing party can get their attorney's fees as well. But those folks who challenged that will, you know, kind of to put it bluntly, got popped for taking this risk when there really was no good basis for it. I mean, the will was very old. It was signed many, many years before the person passed away. There was no issue with capacity. There was no issue with undue influence. The only issue with the document was that both of the witnesses were dead. That was it. Both of the witnesses. And it didn't have a self-proving affidavit. So basically, the statute, if you know the law, the statute deals with that. It says that you have to have evidence of the witnesses' handwriting. And so we hired a handwriting expert and got you know, some tax returns and deeds and things that the witnesses had signed before, put that evidence on, and we followed the statute. We went on summary judgment, and then they got, I mean, it took, yeah, that I've kind of made this short. It took 2 years, okay? It took a long time, but nevertheless. And they got popped for the attorney's fees. So that would be one where, you know, if a client comes into me and I look at all these facts, I'm like, well, hold on a second. Be careful about filing this caveat, because I'm not really seeing the pieces I need to see in this case in order to justify it. And in the event that they want to absolutely press forward because they think there is some good basis for it, they would definitely get a letter from me putting them on notice that I recommended against it. And so those people, obviously, in court yesterday were not happy that they got popped with attorney's fees. But there they were. I mean, that's just the way the law works. So, yes, normally the things that we see, Lockwood, with regard to challenging a will, and that's, you said challenging the state. So challenging the state can be anything. I mean, I could be like administration. It could be like, why are you not filing a lawsuit on this thing? you know, and again, you know, we try to sit down and talk with folks and work things out before we ever go nuclear option.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why would you just jump into litigation? There'd be no need to do that if you can talk first.
Right.
So the things that we see regarding challenging the will are going to be things like will was signed right before the person died.
Right.
The person had a dementia presentation, Alzheimer's diagnosis, something like that, and everyone knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or the person had had caregivers for 2 years before the will was signed and
right.
couldn't really make decisions for themselves. You know, just the things that are pretty logical. A lot of times when we see something like this, is the will is much different than any previous will.
Right.
May leave a majority of the estate to someone that is a surprise to the whole family. Like a caregiver,
mm-hmm.
could be a girlfriend that just kind of showed up at the last second or in the later stages of life. Document could have been signed in the hospital. Who prepared the will? Was it an attorney who prepared it?
Right.
That makes a big difference, because normally if an attorney prepared it and the witnesses from the attorney's office are the actual witnesses to the will, well, they, in most cases, would go through the pomp and circumstance and detail required to make sure everything was done perfectly before they're going to put their name on a will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the attorney. So was it print off the internet and
right.
friends served as witnesses? So, you know, there's just a whole host of things that could get your, you know, kind of get your radar up, could get your that could support bringing a claim like that. Just as much, though, we sometimes aren't close or around the person who signed the will. Let's
right.
say it's like the child who lives in another state
mm-hmm.
and isn't able to see mom very often. We're not sure how bad off she was. Well, a lot of times the medical records, if the person was seeing a doctor or in the hospital around the time the will was signed, will tell a tale for us. Here we are in these type of situations, and, you know, friends and neighbors and family members, and it's interesting how their recollection of things may kind of be skewed based on who they like
mm-hmm.
sometimes.
Right.
Medical records normally are not skewed because they're put in place for purposes of medical care by third parties who don't know anything about a will and don't care.
Right.
So, you know, we always get the medical records.
The aspect of the risk is something that you have to take into consideration. You go, you know, I want to go all the way back to what you said at the opening of our conversation. You want to go into this with the intention of winning the case. You want to win it. You're not going to do something that is weak to begin with. So that's one of the things that I think the audience is listening to, is the fact that, you know, it's one thing just to go through the process, but it's another thing to go through the process with a specific intention of coming out with the best benefit of the client.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, sometimes, Lockwood, you know, this kind of comes to mind as well. You know, as I mentioned before, when a will caveat is filed on either side, the clerk of court is required to enter an order freezing the estate.
Right.
So the money that is going to pass through the estate can't be used to pay for the expense of the caveat.
Ooh.
Okay, so everybody's on their own coin, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, sometimes the circumstances are such that the expense, primarily legal fees, attorney fees, is something that is maybe it's going to be too expensive for folks to be able to cover
uh-huh.
as we go through it. And that could be, you know, quite a deterrent. On kind of rare circumstances, but we've done this, you know, maybe a handful of times, we will do an arrangement with a client on a percentage basis
mm-hmm.
or on some type of other basis, you know, payment at the end. But that is, you know, I'm kind of talking about like
yeah.
how we represent folks in this situation, but that is kind of rare, and that is very risky for the lawyer.
Right.
Because, I mean, I could have $100,000 of time in a file because, I mean, litigation is expensive. The requirements that the court imposes upon you, the work that opposing, I mean, you could have 15 depositions. You could have, you know, multiple expert witnesses. Mm-hmm. You could have multiple hearings. It could go for 2 years, you know, or longer, you know, and it could be, you know, not all of them are $100,000, but it could be, you know,
right.
And, or it could, you know, 20,000, 30, 40, 50, all of us, a lot of money. And so under very certain circumstances, we may do that, but that is incredibly risky because mm-hmm. it's these will caveat cases are all or nothing cases.
Really?
You either, well, yeah, either the will is the will or it's not.
Okay.
So if I take a bad case on a percentage and I lose, well, then I've just done all this work for zero.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For nothing.
Right, right.
I think one of the things that intrigues me on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, because, you know, I'm always in the office, and Wes, of course, is many times in depositions or out at mediations or even, you know, of course, in a trial. But my team, we're there. We hear the stories.
Uh-huh.
We hear about the cases, Wes's cases, I'm referring, and his team, as they develop. And I think what is kind of fascinating to me, Lockwood, is that a lot of Wes's cases begin kind of in a very factually nebulous way.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't really know what happened, you know? And then in comes the medical reports, or in comes the testimony of one of the witnesses to the document. It's just fascinating. And then Wes will come over and say, guess what happened? You know, this witness just, you know, says the following, or the medical reports on page, you know, 240
right.
have something to say about this or that. And then all of a sudden the case, you know, really, what gels, it really comes together. So it's a fascinating area of the law, Lockwood, fiduciary law litigation, because we do not always know where the case is going to go factually. Wes, comment. I mean, Wes, you too are intrigued by that, fascinated by that, week to week to week. I know you are, correct?
Oh, I love getting my evidence in. I
right.
love taking the depositions and getting what I need right. there. I love getting the medical records. I love, you know, kind of honing the case to a fine point to then needing to get, you know, that piece of information. And then I was just thinking of the same terms. It's I go into Cecil's office or Andrew's office when we discuss things, and the first comment is, guess what? or you won't believe this. And it's really interesting the things that you find if you know where to look and know how to be, you know, kind of surgical in identifying what you need and how to get them, get that information. It's really interesting when you get the information that you need to help your client, or sometimes you get information that is not helpful to your client.
And, right.
But then you have to know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, when the client comes in and is concerned about, you know, whatever the issue may be, and this is kind of like, I do litigation in all areas. I mean, I do,
right.
I do breach contract cases. I do business corporation cases, LLC,
right.
Collection, promissory note issues, debts, you know, just across the board, you name it, we litigate those cases. But the fiduciary litigation is what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And in the fiduciary litigation, that's where you have the guess what, you won't believe this kind of comment
right.
more often than not. Because a lot of times, you know, you kind of think about how this works. People don't really know, in most cases, what the will says until the person is deceased.
Right.
And then it has to be put on record. And then everybody is like, oh, my gosh. That's where the shock comes.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the client then sits down with us and kind of explains it to us, we know the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
That tip of the iceberg needs to look pretty good for us to proceed forward. But if it does, then we're going to get the rest of the iceberg. We're going to put the whole picture together. And as we're going through that process is when we have this guess what, or you won't believe this kind of moments. It's interesting.
I mean, we can't get too specific talking about a file, Lockwood, because, you know, the confidentiality. But, you know, we've spoken so many times about these beneficiary designation forms, mm-hmm. these payable on death, joint with right of survivorship. My goodness, in this world, we have got an office full of litigated files as a result of those concepts.
I'm going off.
Well, that was what I'm leading up to. Yes, exactly, Wes.
Sure.
I could go off on a tangent, but I feel like the North Carolina legislature needs to rescind these laws concerning payable on death and mm-hmm. joint with right of survivorship, these things that are signed at the teller window or out in the automobile or, you know, in the office of the broker
mm-hmm.
who is, you know, with the daughters standing right there. And it's just...
The beneficiary designations on life insurance and annuities basically is unregulated completely.
Oh, my goodness.
Correct.
So, I mean, you can go leave your $1 million annuity to anyone you want to, you know, basically based on a document that gets sent to you and someone drops by the office.
Not even under notary.
Yeah, not under notary. Yep, that's there's no notary correct. On those forms.
That's right. So we have all these files, and several of them, you know, are the client comes in, oh, no, we're not the beneficiary, such and such. She signed something to somebody. We don't really know who they were, but, you know, we're in the will, but we now hear that there's a, you know, $400,000 account somewhere that she named, you know, to the housekeeper or to the person who was coming by to help with the care. These folks, bless their hearts, they don't know where in the world to do. They don't know where to go. They don't know what to think. They've just simply, they knew that they're, that they were the beneficiary, but they had no idea that there would be an account, an annuity, something of that nature mm-hmm. that would not pass to them because they had been told that they were the beneficiary. And there is a will, in fact, that leaves them the beneficiary. And so here we go. And of course, you know, then these facts in all of these files begin to develop, as I was mentioning earlier and Wes also was talking about, you know, and then all of a sudden there is that, quote, guess what moment, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that was signed by text message.
Mm-hmm.
That was signed, you know, that's not even her signature. Someone made that, you know, all of these kinds of things. But, of course, you know, it takes time to develop these factual scenarios. So it's a fascinating area, fiduciary law litigation. It is also, and we're going to close out here in a moment or two, but I just happen to know, because this is what Wes and I do, that fiduciary law litigation is one of the most growth-oriented areas of substantive law practice. Many of the firms in Raleigh, Greensboro, great law firms in mm-hmm. Charlotte, you know, of course, great law firms here in New Bern and Moorhead City, you know, are very, very busy in the area of fiduciary law litigation. And a lot of times over these designated beneficiary forms, and other kinds of, you know, opportunities to frustrate the real true last will and testament of the testator.
You know, that as we close out on that, I think that the important aspect of this is twofold. One, that anyone interested in or concerned about a will caveat challenging a will needs to know that it's not something that you do just casually. You just don't walk in and do it. You're going to be asked a lot of hard questions by your potential attorney, your representative, and that, of course, being Cecil Harvell or Wes Collins, in this particular case, Wes Collins. And the second aspect of it is you don't know what you don't know until you discover it, that sort of thing,
yeah.
Right, Wes?
That's right, exactly. that's kind of the story of life. You don't know what you don't know, and everything is fine until it's not.
Exactly.
That's kind of like the best advice I could give as an attorney, but that's right.
All right. I want to thank, I'm smiling when you say that, but it's a serious comment. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal. And again, just to remind you, please do not hesitate to make that phone call. 252 area code 726-9050. A simple phone call just to start out with. And from that point on, you can learn a lot. Thank you very much to both of you, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, here on Let's Talk Legal.